Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Steve Scott and Stephanie Collins. We're recording on Wednesday morning. I was looking at an article at CBS News, believe it or not, about the climate crisis, but this one blew my mind. So I wanted to start with this little nugget before we introduce our first guest. And the title of the piece was, Does the Hurricane Scale Need a Category 6? New climate study found 5 recent storms have met the threshold. And they write, as global temperatures continue to increase, making storms more intense, some researchers say that the Saffir-Simpson scale, which measures a hurricane's wind speeds, doesn't adequately address the hazards associated with extreme storms. In a new study, scientists explored a hypothetical expansion of the scale to include a what? A Category 6, and found that such a designation could help focus people of the worsening risks. Oh my God. In the study published on Monday in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers found that the scale, which was created in the early 1970s, is still used to define hurricane categories, has a weakness. Where is the weakness? It tops out at Category 5, even though the destructive potential of the wind increases exponentially. The hurricane categories run from 1 to 5. With Category 5 hurricanes having winds of 156 miles per hour or stronger, enough to produce catastrophic damage, which NOAA says could result in complete roof failure on many residences and industrial buildings, as well as extreme and extended power outages. Michael Wellner, lead author of the latest research, told CBS News that there have been several hurricanes in recent years which have far surpassed 156 miles per hour and that may warrant an entirely new category. They said that they have now seen wind speeds that have exceeded 200 miles per hour. Oh my God. Oh my God. And as I'm reading this, I'm thinking about what's going on in California with the floods and the rains and everything else. And I keep thinking, how do you prepare for this? I mean, have we re-examined what FEMA is going to be responsible for doing? This is about economic costs. It's about social costs. How do you help your neighbor? Look at this. Look at these, over 200 miles per hour. Anyway, so I want to sort of lay that out there because we cannot forget about the climate crisis as we move forward and look at the election of 2024. But then I read this, and there were two articles that I read that got me so ticked off. And basically, in a lot of ways, they're a description of corruption. As many of you know, who do we have on every Friday? We have on Bill Curry. Bill Curry is one of the most smart, articulate, thoughtful guys I know. He ran for the governorship of Connecticut twice. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton, head of the nuclear freeze movement. Just an incredibly thoughtful guy, a very good writer. And what does he talk about every Friday? He talks about one word over and over again, and the word is corruption. Well, let me share with you the title of the next two pieces that we're going to be talking about, because in a lot of ways, this is about the definition of corruption. Here's the first one. The oligarch exemption for new business disclosure rules have, after a multi-million dollar lobbying blitz, Wall Street firms got themselves exempted from anti-money laundering requirements being imposed on small businesses. I'm shocked. I'm shocked. But then here's the follow-up story. That's the national story. Let's take it to New York. Oh, what's in New York? Wall Street, Manhattan, finance, real estate, formerly Donald Trump. And what is the title of the second piece? Shadow Landlords Strike Back. Backed by real estate money, Governor Kathy Hochul refused to make public the secret problematic companies that own a wide swath of New York. Writing about these two stories is Helen Santoro. She is a freelance journalist who covers health, neuroscience, wildlife, climate change, and LGBTQ communities. And these were two pieces that she wrote at the Lever. Is it the Lever or the Lever? How do you pronounce it, Helen?
The Lever.
The Lever, the Lever. All right. So I have to dedicate these to Bill. He talks about corruption over and over again. And I am reading your two stories and I am screaming, Bill, Bill, read this, read this. And it is just so depressing. But before you get into the stories, I want you to know that I'm a little bit aware of this, but I'm aware of it from back in the 1980s. So in the 1980s, I was a very young legislator, and we had two bankrupt utilities. They decided that they were going to unload the bankrupt utilities to a company in Massachusetts. There had been another number of companies that were competing to acquire this utility, but the governor put his finger on the scale with the help of his lobbyist, who is also the head of his campaign reelect, and they decided that they would go with this one company in Massachusetts. Well, my brother calls me up and says, you know, this deal is a piece of crap. Now, my brother's this big Wall Street tycoon. And I said, why? He said, you're getting garbage back in the way of payment. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, do you realize that most of this money is going to junk bond holders? And junk bond holders are receiving 100 cents on the dollar for what they probably purchased for 5 cents on the dollar. This is BS. And I said, well, how do I find that out? And he said, why don't you call and find out who owns the junk bonds? Guess what, Helen? The junk bonds were owned in street name. So I could not find who the actual owners were. They were owned by Merrill Lynch. They were owned by, you know, all these names of these companies, but I could not find who the individual owners were because of that. So we knew someone was going to the bank, making a ton of cash on this incredibly bad deal. We were being forced into this deal. We were not able to look at any other deal. And it turns out that it's the governor's top lobbyist, or the person who was going to be responsible for his reelect, was also the lobbyist for this firm. So there I was. I had no ability to point a finger as to who actually was going to benefit, but we were all suspect. Did the deal go through? Of course it did. And that was back in the 1980s, Helen. I knew that it was corrupt. I knew that that we needed transparency. I just couldn't get there. So let's fast forward to your first story about the oligarch exemption for new business disclosures rules. After a multi-million-dollar lobbying blitz, Wall Street firms get themselves exempted from anti-money laundering requirements being imposed on small business. So welcome to the program, Helen, and explain to us a little bit about how we got to this, what the original legislation was going to require, and why did we burden small business, as if that's the place where most of the money laundering is going, and how did we, you know, actually embrace the idea that Wall Street and big business should actually be exempt? Because this to me is just the most appalling thing I have read in a long time, but it's not surprising.
Yeah, well, the issue you brought up back in the 80s is exactly what's still happening today. So perhaps to no surprise to you, Arnie, but maybe to other people, the United States is a really big area for money laundering for exactly that reason. People can make an LLC, a limited liability corporation, and then they don't have to disclose their own personal name. So exactly what you said, that has happened with Russian oligarchs, where you look into these huge penthouses or things bought with an LLC, and it's just a street name, and it's impossible to find who's really behind this stuff. So therefore, what is known as beneficial owners, or people who have a substantial, although sometimes obscured, control over a business, can really hide who they are and get their money into the United States financial system. Senators like Elizabeth Warren have been saying that this is a huge issue in the United States. The Panama Papers really exposed that in international corruption, but this is happening right here at home. So this Corporate Transparency Act, which was under the defense spending bill, was really trying to expose these beneficial owners. However, as you mentioned, Wall Street has deep pockets. So these hedge funds and private equity funds, which are known as pooled investment vehicles, that are really prime areas for this money laundering, they are left out of this Corporate Transparency Act, which basically requires businesses to disclose who their beneficial owners are to a database that's run by the U.S. Department of Treasury. So you could then technically go on and see who owns these LLCs. But for example, my freelance LLC, Helen Santoro LLC, which it's not as if I was trying to hide my name in the first place.
Right.
I will have to disclose that, or your local, you know, coffee shop will have to disclose who really owns it. But big private equity, hedge funds, and venture capitals, they won't have to disclose that. And it's pretty obvious after doing this reporting, you know, that the people who are trying to launder money aren't going through your local coffee shop, I guess, although they could, or your local bookstore. They're going through these big private equity firms. And yet they're shielded from this due to a lobbying blitz on their part.
I wanted to take a shower after reading your piece. I'm telling you, because, and if I was small business, I would be outraged. I want you to go and speak to every Rotary in every state in the country, okay? Because that's where small business hangs out. They don't hang out at the Chamber of Commerce. They hang out at their Rotaries. And they should be understanding what they're being burdened to do as if they're laundering a cent. And maybe they are, but it may be a cent as opposed to billions of dollars. And that's why when I'm reading this, I'm like, then what's the point? What's the point? All you're doing is basically aiding, you know what you're doing? You're aiding and abetting Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump keeps talking about all that regulatory burden, all that regulatory burden. Elect me president and I'll get rid of all those regulations. Well, no wonder, because there's no regulations really happening for big business and Wall Street and finance. But where are all the regulations being burdened on? On small business. This is not sharing the burden. This is about targeting the burden on the people that are probably the least responsible for the kind of money laundering that you're talking about. But I love the excuse that you get. Listen to this. I mean, again, I'm going to read from your article. Once the law passed, the Treasury Department was charged with issuing detailed rules and requirements for companies to comply with the statute. At the time, transparency groups urged regulators to issue as narrow an exemption as possible. But AIC pressed Treasury regulators to apply the exemption not merely to pooled investment vehicles, but also to the firm's complex web of subsidiaries and affiliates. I mean, they wanted to drive a freaking Mack truck through it. But their excuse made me want to gag. As justification, the group insisted that the lifespan of a private equity fund is usually only 10 to 12 years, meaning it takes that much time to gather money from investors, invest that money into businesses, and sell those businesses for a profit. Criminals would prefer quick access to their ill-gotten gains, AIC wrote. The group also noted that since there typically are restrictions on cash withdrawals from the fund lifespan, private equity funds are unattractive for money laundering. Now, I'm sitting there and I'm going, okay, 12 or 13 years, I could do a lot of damage in 12 or 13 years, you know? And I mean, again, they're just so that they're unattractive for money laundering. Well, that depends on the eye of the beholder. You know, if you know that you're not required to disclose, it becomes very attractive. And that's the whole point. The point is disclosure is not attractive. What is unattractive is the fact you would have to sort of share information. So if 12 years, it's a lifespan for someone who wants to launder their cash. It's an unbelievable bunch of bull. My question is, why did people buy it?
I mean, and I think that's exactly it. Even the FBI, through a leaked bulletin in 2020, revealed that criminal actors, and this is a quote from what was leaked in the bulletin, are likely to use the private placement of funds, including investments offered by hedge funds and private equity firms, to launder money, circumventing traditional anti-money laundering programs. So It is, what is being said by these lobbying organizations just isn't true. Even the FBI says that these organizations are really big for money laundering. And I think just unfortunately, like a lot of issues of corruption in this country, it's deep pockets that makes people listen. It's just a lot of money spent on lobbying and spent talking to legislators. And that holds a lot of weight in these.
And I hate to break it to you, but the financial boys lie. And why do I say that? Because I went back to another part of your article, which again, blows my mind. Much of the financial sector, including banks, mutual funds, credit unions, broker dealers, even casinos and bond shops, are already required to abide by specific anti-money laundering rules enacted after September 11, 2001. Oh, how lovely. Isn't this great? That included the Patriot Act, which requires financial institutions to establish anti-money laundering programs that detect illicit money and prevent these funds from entering the U.S. financial system. Now, this was the sentence that absolutely blew me away. However, now listen to this, everyone. However, the Treasury Department temporarily exempted investment companies from these rules in 2002. The department planned to first tackle other financial sectors and then move on to private investment companies. Nevertheless, the two-decade-old exemption still stands today, thereby allowing hedge funds, private equity funds, and other pooled investment vehicles to bypass anti-money laundering laws. Consequently, such funds can accept and manage massive sums of cash without knowing who their investors are, an appealing arrangement to those who wish to invest money while remaining anonymous. I want a temporary exemption from 2002 that is now 22 years later, and the temporary is still here. I'm just like, we gotta make the documentary. We gotta make the movie. I'm reading this and I'm thinking, this is outrageous. This is outrageous. But Helen, what's so sad is that again, I want to connect this to Donald Trump. Because in a lot of ways, this is exactly how he feeds his base. He looks at small business and says, look at your burdens, look at your burdens. I'll take away the regulations. Well, no wonder. You know, there are no regulations on Wall Street and hedge funds and finances. Just on, as you point out, the mom and pop grocery store or the coffee shop. And no wonder people are ticked off because regulations aren't across the board. They overburden small business that basically isn't really responsible for so much of the corruption we're talking about. And the boys of corruption, they get exempt. Now let's go to my least favorite governor. Well, actually, not true. She's not my least favorite, but there are so many that I don't like. But I'll move Kathy Hochul into the category. Your second piece is about what's going on in New York. And of course, what we know is housing is such a huge issue. Affordable housing is such a huge issue. Safe housing is such a huge issue. So you really want to know who your landlord is. You want to be able to take your landlord to task. You want to be able to sue. You want to be able to protect your ability to afford your rent, to make sure that, you know, whatever's wrong with your apartment is done. And you also want to know, like, what's the playing field? Like, who am I working with? And your second piece, shadow landlords strike back, backed by real estate money. Governor Kathy Hochul refused to make public the secret problematic companies that own a wide swath of New York. All right, my second corruption story. So explain to us what the original bill was intended to do and how Kathy Hochul, the Democratic governor of New York, everyone, remember after Andrew Cuomo left, she stepped in and then she got reelected. I don't know why. Anyway, explain to us exactly what she did.
Right. So this is, they had a LLC Transparency Act, New York legislators, that was very similar to the Corporate Transparency Act, really trying to, you know, focus in on making transparent who owns real estate companies and other companies in New York State. Because real estate, very similar to LLCs, a lot of big names with big, deep pockets can come into Manhattan real estate and buy up penthouses or big condos or buildings without disclosing who they are. So again, another prime example of a place for money laundering. So the original bill was going to make it so that these individuals who have these LLCs had to disclose their beneficial owners really owns these businesses to a public database that you and I could go and access. However, perhaps no surprise, real estate people were not a fan of that idea, the public part of it. There was a good quote from Brick Underground that interviewed a Sotheby's international realty broker that said this was, quote, extraordinarily invasive for luxury buyers who, quote, don't want others to know how much they're spending. So, I mean, it's right there why they're against this idea. So, in the end, last December, when Governor Hochul actually signed the bill, LLCs do have to disclose who their owners are, but it's not to a public database. Only government and law enforcement officials can actually access this database, which, according to advocates and the original co-sponsor of the bill, like really takes the heart out of the bill because the whole point was transparency so that if you have, like you said, if you have a bad landlord, if you're not getting paid, there's wage theft going on in New York,
Right.
you can actually access who really is behind these businesses and go after them. But now you really can't. It's really actually quite hard to find out who really owns these properties in New York.
Under your paragraph, Manhattan's secretive realty. Woo. Anonymous shell companies have been used far too long to break the law and harm New Yorkers, a coalition of 24 advocacy groups, including Reinvent Albany, wrote in a letter to Hochul in support of the LLC Transparency Act. Detractors seem to come from exactly one place. Ooh, the real estate market for luxury condominiums in New York City, a market historically rife with money laundering, facilitated by, of course, anonymous shell companies. I feel like repeat rinse, repeat rinse, repeat rinse. I'm reading the other story and then I'm reading this one and I'm going, oh, my head is exploding. Even U.S. Department of Treasury Secretary and Brooklyn Ray's Janet Yellen called out Central Park skyscrapers as means for corrupt actors to hide their money. Indeed, sometimes the only thing these luxury properties are home to are ill-gotten gains. They're money laundromats on the 81st floor. What a great line, money laundromats. Yellen said at the 2021 Summit for Democracy, a meeting hosted by the U.S. to renew democracy at home and confront autocracies abroad. LLC's secrecy provisions attract foreign buyers who can make multi-million dollar purchases without much scrutiny. So they go on to explain sort of what's happened. But this is interesting because it turns out that law enforcement can actually find this information out. Now they have to be disclosed to the government. But the whole point of what Hochul did, which I think is interesting, is she sort of split the baby. And what she said is, well, if you're worried about corruption and whatever, who really wants to know about corruption is the government. So we're going to give the government access to actually who are the names behind these LLCs, but we're not going to give it to the guy who's been stiffed for painting the apartment. We're not going to give it to the person who actually rents the slum room. So the public is the enemy, okay, that we don't trust. But we trust government to be able to do something. So how do we explain to Kathy why it really is important that the public have access to this information? Because the people that are the most vulnerable, they may not rise to the top of the money laundering opportunities, but they are going to be the most vulnerable because they're the ones that are going to face eviction. They're the ones that are not going to get paid. They're the ones that really need a immediate response and they need to go after someone. And an LLC is like, you know, punching a black hole. Because you have no idea what you're doing. So I'm just trying to figure out whose privacy is she protecting except rich people.
I mean, you look at who, I spent a lot of time going through who donated to her campaign, and it's a lot of big name real estate families in New York. You have Tishman Speyer, a massive real estate firm that owns Rockefeller Center. You have Scott Rutschler of RXR Realty that manages 25 million square feet of commercial properties. You know, it's a lot of these, the Durst family and the Durst organizations. These are families that if you go to Manhattan, they're going to be spotting, you know, their names will come up time and time again on the properties throughout Manhattan. So they donated a lot of money to Hochul's governor campaign. Because I believe they want to stay, you know, keep their names secret from their LLCs.
But you end this way, and this is like, can we talk chump change? Let's talk chump change. Because when they basically decided that it would not apply to the public, one of the ways she did her mea culpa, Kathy Hochul, oh, come on, honey bun. Anyway, this is, I couldn't stop laughing. Failure to comply with the LLC Transparency Act will result in a fine of up to $500 a day for each day that a company's filing is past due. Businesses will also be suspended from operating in New York until they report their owners to the state as a peace offering offered by Hochul after the public database was removed. Speaker said the fine amount was doubled from $250 a day charge to the $500 a day charge. Now, they fine that $500 under their car seat.
Yes.
Okay. $500, boys and girls, is a joke. It is a joke. When you are a multimillionaire, you earn $500 in a second. In a second. So this raising it from 250 to 500, what do you think I am, stupid? I mean, it's like unbelievable. But here's where I have to end this conversation. So businesses will also be suspended from operating in New York until they report their owners to the state. How long before they'll be suspended? Do you know?
It didn't say in the legislation exactly how many days.
Well, Kathy Hochul will figure that one out, I'm sure. How about 10 to 12 years? Isn't that what they said about the hedge funds or whatever it was? I'm sure that's a short period of time. Anyway, your two pieces were absolutely fabulous, and I want to get you back. And I do dedicate this conversation to Bill Curry, who's constantly talking about corruption. Well, if he cares about corruption, I sent him your two articles. They're entitled "The Oligarch Exemption for New Business Disclosure Rules After a Multi-Million Dollar Lobbying Blitz: Wall Street Firms Got Themselves Exempted, Oh, from Anti-Money Laundering Requirements," and "Shadow Landlords Strike Back." Backed by real estate money, Kathy Hochul refused to make public the secret and problematic companies that own a wide swath of New York. Helen Santoro, thank you so much for doing this. It's so important. We need to be exposed to this. This is corruption. This is corruption. And I want to remind you, New York is a blue state. New York is a blue state, a pox on both parties. With that, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
Good fences make good water. On this current cast. Cows wading in a stream might make a pretty picture, but the reality is a lot less pleasant. Jean Can is a microbiologist with Stroud Research Center. He's been monitoring streams in the Delaware River watershed for bacteria that are present as a result of fecal contamination. And he's found high levels, especially in summer.
We try to understand why we have that high number of bacteria and how can we reduce those bacteria.
Ken says possible causes include leaky septic systems and runoff from nearby farm fields. But wading cows also contribute by excreting waste directly in the water. So he says fencing livestock out of streams can help protect water quality. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Why should we care that an Alabama DA has brought criminal charges against a small-town newspaper publisher and reporter? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The Atmore, Alabama News printed a truthful and accurate story about an investigation that the local DA has been conducting about the Escambia County School Board. Truthful and accurate. In response, the DA charged the publisher and reporter with disclosing grand jury information. The problem? While grand jurors may well have an obligation to remain silent, newspapers are not grand jurors. Newspapers have a very different obligation. Newspapers have the obligation and the right to inform the public. And newspapers, we've understood, have the right to publish grand jury information, as long as they didn't use illegal means to obtain it. Here, the DA has not alleged any such thing. As one press freedom organization put it, if the Nixon administration couldn't imprison journalists who printed the Pentagon Papers, the Alabama DA can't imprison journalists for writing stories about the Atmore, Alabama school board. And then the story gets worse. As a condition of release on bond, the judge imposed a prior restraint order prohibiting the reporter and the paper's publisher from printing any more stories relating to a grand jury unless the information already is first a public record, teaching us that freedom of the press, or not, as a practical matter, may depend on where you live. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom can't protect itself.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss, when you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race, when you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019,
it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept, locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on Wednesday morning. One of my friends is a publicist, and he sent me a new book. By Felicia Kornblau. A woman's life is a human life. My mother, our neighbor, and the journey from reproductive rights to reproductive justice. Before I bring in the author of the book, she's also a professor of gender studies in Vermont, I want to read something that I posted on Facebook after beginning to understand why she wrote this book. And here's what hit me. Why is diversity, equity, and inclusion so essential? I read this frightening fact from a recent post. Involuntary sterilization programs have always targeted women of color. By 1968, in Puerto Rico alone, 35% of women of childbearing age had been sterilized. For women in Puerto Rico, it was not about ending a pregnancy. It was about the ability to procreate. Felicia, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. She specializes in the histories of feminism, gender, social welfare, disability, law, Jews in the United States, and reproductive politics. She is a professor of history and gender, sexuality, and women's studies, and affiliated faculty in Jewish studies. And you teach in Vermont. You teach at the University of Vermont, I take it. Am I correct?
Yeah, I'm in Burlington right now.
The conversation about sterilization and abortion, these two parallel tracks, which is what your book really sort of follows, was so powerful. But I suddenly realized now more than ever that diversity, equity, and inclusion, diversity doesn't just mean female. It means our diversity of experience within that umbrella called female. You know, that my experience as a white female growing up on Long Island is very different from a Black woman growing up in Detroit, or a Puerto Rican woman growing up in Puerto Rico, or whatever. And we're all women, and we all have women's health issues. But what society has done, what policy has done, the expectations on us, the outcomes that people are seeking or society is seeking may be very different. Until I became aware of this in your book, I hadn't focused on it. So I need to ask you to tell us the story that sort of really is the underlying story to this book, because it's really the story of your mother and her neighbor. And because of these two women, not only did you tell us a history we were totally unaware of, but you also told us about a bridge that had not initially been built, that we didn't see each other. We were both women, we were working on women's health, but we didn't realize that we needed each other. And that's what this book is so powerful about, is how much we need each other, we need to talk to each other, and we need to recognize that while our experiences may be different, we are so connected.
Well, that's right. I love that that's what you got from reading the book. So my starting point was my own mother, who played an important role, and a role I didn't know about very, very sadly until she was gone. But she played a really important role in legalizing abortion, just in one state, in the state of New York, but that wound up being a kind of unknown foundation for Roe versus Wade. What they did in New York and what my mom in particular did in New York wound up being a foundation for Roe v. Wade. So that was the first strand of the story. And I also studied this woman who was our neighbor for about a decade, lived right across the hall. There were two apartments on the hall. So it was just ours and hers. And she was a Puerto Rican woman doctor, completely pioneering, you know, as somebody who got that training in her generation. And she became a leading pediatrician and one of the founders of the Committee to End Sterilization Abuse, calling out the American healthcare system and the government of Puerto Rico and the government of the United States for the way that it pushed low-income women and non-white women into sterilization, especially when it wasn't really what people wanted. You know, sometimes it was, but a lot of the time it wasn't what people wanted, but they were threatened. They were threatened with the loss of their welfare or their health insurance. And sometimes, like we know this from Fannie Lou Hamer, the civil rights activist, sometimes women would just go into the hospital for some other procedure. Right. And they would come out and they would have had, they would have been given, right, they would be sterilized. They would have had a hysterectomy or something like that, you know, which is a pretty big deal surgery to have, especially without your own consent. So the story is about how my mom and Helen in particular, but the movements that they were part of, how sometimes they worked together and sometimes they were kind of in parallel. And then sometimes, especially the white middle-class women who were fighting for abortion rights didn't get on board with the agenda of women of color, working-class women. They didn't understand it, and they even fought the agenda of the women of color sometimes. So that's the story I tell.
So I got to ask, how did you not know about this about your mother until she dies? I mean, I kind of get it. I mean, I remember going to a funeral for actually the guy that owned this house before I did. And I knew him and I thought I knew him very well. And then I went to the funeral and I was gobsmacked about all the pieces of his life I had no idea he had done. I mean, I knew I kind of liked him and I knew I kind of admired him. I was like stunned when I walked out. But that was the guy who owned my house. This is your mother. I got to ask mother. You, Felicia. It's your mother. So tell me, who was your mother? How was she so involved in this abortion fight? How, as you credit her for what she was able to do in New York, which laid the foundation for Roe v. Wade, what was the motivator for her? What gave her both the power, the voice, and frankly, the bully pulpit to be able to drive this, not only this conversation and this need, but turn it into something so powerful as a law in New York?
Yeah, well, first I'll say, maybe in my own defense, like there was kind of a story in my family about how the law that legalized abortion in New York was written in our living room. It was something that my dad used to say. My mother never said it. I don't know. She was weirdly modest. My dad used to say that. And I never knew what it meant. And it was only literally after my mother passed away that I started to get a little bit of the real story. My sister and my father had a conversation about it that completely blew me away. And then at my mother's memorial service, this guy who used to serve in the state legislature in New York stood up and he said, "Yes, it was your mother who lobbied me and persuaded me and got me to be the original sponsor of this bill." And the bill was actually drafted by my mom. She was a lawyer by training, but in her free time, which, you know, she had three young children at home, so not a ton of free time, but in her free time, she was part of the National Organization for Women. And particularly, she joined their committee on contraception and abortion. And because she was the only lawyer on the committee, they said, okay, Beatrice, her name was Beatrice Kornbluh. Okay, Beatrice, like, it's our position, it's our group's position, that we want a full repeal of all abortion restrictions, right? We want to simply remove abortion from the legal code and give people the freedom to make their own choices. And they said, okay, Beatrice, it's your job to figure out how to turn that into legal language. How do we turn that into a law, right? Or into a draft law. And that's what my mom did. She went through the state legal code, page after page. You know, there's no computer to help her. And she found all the places where abortion was mentioned, and she designed a draft law that would simply remove abortion entirely from the legal code and leave it up to individual pregnant people and their doctors and their clergy and their family members, but no business of the states. That was what she did.
So one of the things I assume is that this wasn't just about now, and it wasn't just about women, that what they also needed was they sort of needed also a moral foundation. And that moral foundation, and I will think about some of the sort of progressive clergy that also got involved with this. So this was something that I think what's so important about this fight is that it has many fingers. You know, there isn't a simple solution. It wasn't just women getting up. It wasn't just progressive women getting up, but that it needed a lot of, like, you know, oars in the ocean to be able to move this. So what did you learn as you were studying the story of your mother and New York that led to Roe v. Wade? Tell me about the different players that they were able to tap. Because I as a young legislator, I learned that the hard way. I had passed a piece of legislation dealing with access to healthcare for part-time workers. First time ever in the United States. Guess who freaking vetoed it? Governor Sununu, as in John. And I was so shocked because I was naive. I was like, oh my God, look what I did. But because you, when you veto a bill, you can reintroduce it. Guess what I did? I brought the business community in. I brought the medical community in. I brought part-time workers in. Unions in. And so when we went the second time around, I wasn't naive. I was much smarter, but I knew that I needed to attack and I needed to look at the gestalt of people that would be impacted by this, bring them together, because we formed a much bigger force. And guess what? He didn't veto it the second time. So tell me about the story about, like, how did they organize and how did they pull all the different groups together?
Yeah, it was definitely a many oars kind of situation, right? Well, the first thing is that it wasn't just liberal Democrats, right? It was also liberal Republicans. And there were people in the Republican Party in those days who were really committed to these issues, you know, and who were willing to stand up for them. So that's just inside the legislature. But yeah, on the ground, it was every kind of feminist, right? From the most radical to the most moderate, except for some Catholic feminists who are anti-abortion. And then it was people who were interested in quote unquote population control who were part of that coalition. That wasn't a part of the coalition that we identify with today. But there were those people who thought, you know, the United States has too much population and it's a drain on our resources and so on. So there was that piece. And then there were people making the moral argument. There were clergy. There actually was a national network of clergy called the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion, headquartered in New York, right? And they found hundreds and hundreds of women safe abortions, which were not exactly legal, but they weren't exactly illegal either. They were kind of in a gray zone. And so there were clergy all over the country who were invested in this issue. And they were saying to deprive people of this, that's the moral wrong. Right, to get in their way when people are in need and when people think, you know, this is an appropriate choice for them. That's the moral wrong, not having the abortion. That to them, that was not the moral problem. So they were very influential and important. And they were people, they had really come into politics through the Black Civil Rights Movement.
Right.
There was a wing of that movement that was in the North, that was working in major cities in the North. And these were mostly white clergy. But they had gotten involved in fights against housing segregation and school segregation, right? So they made those arguments. And they wound up with a very powerful and large coalition that could really get stuff done. And as long as people were focused on this, on the same aim, you know, even if it was from different philosophical, you know, strategic, blah, blah, you know, perspectives, as long as they were working on the same aim, they could get it. They could get it over the line.
This is not uncommon, Felicia. We finally banned the death penalty in New Hampshire. And how did we ban the death penalty in New Hampshire? The libertarians and the liberals got together. Now, the libertarians didn't necessarily have the same raison d'etre for why they wanted to ban the death penalty, but they didn't trust government. Okay.
That's right.
And so people are saying, well, how could you have worked with them? I said, because the result was what we both wanted. You know, and I'm not going to, it's kind of like, you know, why do you believe in this God? There are many paths to God. I'm not going to tell you yours is better than mine, but you know, as long as wherever you need to go, you get there, that's fine. But again, so I saw that with the death penalty fight, that's exactly the kind of thing. And to a large extent, people need to understand that there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. There are a lot of reasons why people want to achieve a goal, and it may not be what you define, but here's the beauty of choice. You get to make that decision based on your needs. This is about you. You know, you may decide you don't want children because you think the world is overpopulated. You may decide you don't want children because, you know, you're only 15 years old and you are, you know, impregnated by your father. You may not, so who am I to dictate? So tell me the story about sterilization though. So tell me about when did it ultimately happen that they began to understand that they needed each other? Did that ultimately occur? Or are we still sort of seeing sort of a parallel track?
Unfortunately, it's more of a parallel track or even even sometimes conflict. And it's not just a straight up story of Black people versus white people, or Puerto Ricans versus, you know, or Latinas versus non-Latinas. You know, there definitely were white feminists who were fighting sterilization abuse, right? They tended to be people who were already involved in the civil rights movement, who had already been working with non-white people and working class and poor people, right? So for my mom, the sterilization abuse stuff was not really on her radar. You know, right. she didn't really ever see it. And in large part, it was because it used to be hard, and sometimes still is hard, for white middle class married people to get a sterilization procedure if they wanted it, right? There were all kinds of barriers. Hospitals wouldn't do it. Doctors wouldn't do it. There were all kinds of barriers on the one side for somebody who wanted to have that procedure, right? And on the other side, you have situations like, famously in LA, there was a scandal of the hospital that was sued by women for basically pushing them into sterilization if they were Mexican American or Mexican,
right?
Right. And we saw it more recently under the Trump administration. There was an ICE holding facility, right? Yeah. That a whistleblower called our attention to the fact that there was a doctor who was pushing people into hysterectomies. I think in that case, just because it made him a lot of money, you know. So what happened was the sterilization group, it was its own coalition that was also very powerful and big, but it was a different coalition from the ones who legalized abortion, right? There's some overlap, and then there's some different players involved. And one of the fascinating things I thought was that in New York, at least, when they actually got some new rules around sterilization, the Catholic Church was in support of that. So they worked with the anti-sterilization people, who were mostly left-wing feminists and Puerto Rican feminists and Black feminists. They were working quietly with some Catholic leaders who also were opposed to sterilization. And one member of the city council said, "You know, well, I guess I have to be in favor of this because."
Well, that makes sense.
No,
that
makes it. Are together, right?
Right. But that makes a lot of sense because they see the essence of procreation as almost a sacrament. I mean, it's like it's so important. So I'm going back to something we were talking about, the difference between a white woman's experience and maybe the experience of people of color, people of poverty, or people working in the civil rights movement. And I remember having a huge fight with my Roman Catholic conservative mother. And she was telling me that I had an obligation to procreate because there were too many of the other kind, and therefore I needed to have more children. All right. As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about the forced sterilization in Puerto Rico, and I'm thinking about my mother, and I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, as you mentioned, white women, white affluent middle-class women would have a difficult time getting a sterilization. My mother would be one of those people who would say, no, you must have children. You know what I mean? And it's all part of, like, what do they want as an end result? And they want white babies. That's the end result. It's not even about babies. It's about white babies, which is what the ultimate goal here is. And I just thought it was just so, so shocking. So you wrote this for the 50th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Of course, we have the Dobbs decision. And now everything is chaos. And it's chaos because they claim to have thrown it back to the states. And now we know how many states now have incredibly restrictive abortion bans. And not only that, but their restrictive abortion bans, Felicia, they're actually encroaching on blue states, on states that actually have pro-choice positions, because they're now going to follow women as they leave the state. They're going to deputize people in Texas. So if you happen to, like, you know, drive a woman in an Uber in New York to get an abortion, you know, you can actually be sued in Texas because you were somehow connected to this Texas woman who had an abortion in New York. So as we look at what is happening with each passing hour, the consequences of Dobbs is getting more and more horrific. We're finding out, I feel like it's like looking at a lake where you throw a stone in, and the concentric ring circles keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's scooping in more and more people, more and more consequences for doctors and states and communities. What do we do? What do we do? What did you learn from your mother's experience? And how do we then translate into what the new fight is?
Well, I think, first of all, I take the point about your concentric circles, but it's not all bad news, right? We need to say about the current time, it's not all bad news. And it's not all bad news because people have been organizing like hell at the ground level, right? And there's been that there've been people in the streets, but there also have been people who have been working at the electoral level and the ballot level, and people are getting elected to office who never would have even thought about running for office before, right? I think all those things make a difference. And that would be the lesson of the book, I think. What happened in the 60s was, in some ways, it seemed just as bad. You know, it was really a bad situation. After World War II, the number of injuries and deaths due to illegal abortion actually increased. You know, at a time when medicine is getting more safe, there are more people who are getting damaged, right? Because there's more prosecution and abortion is more in the shadows, right? And people go to kind of unscrupulous, untrained medical practitioners or non-medical, you know, non-medical practitioners who say that they know how to do this, right? So there were abortion wards in the hospitals. People would come in, you know, with all kinds of
complications.
With complications. I didn't even know the right kind of word to describe how awful it was. And what happened was, within a short space of time, they were able to change everything in terms of the political climate, right? In 1966, 1967, they thought, we're never going to be able to do this. We're going to need like a constitutional amendment. A federal constitutional amendment, or else we're never going to be able to change these laws. Mm-hmm. And by 1970 in New York, they have a complete change in the law. And then, of course, in 1973, they get the United States Supreme Court to say in Roe versus Wade that people can make their own choices overwhelmingly in the first two trimesters of a pregnancy. It's a huge sea change. And that happens because they do everything. They do the grassroots stuff. They do the demonstrations. People yell and scream during congressional hearings. You know, when doctors are being prosecuted for performing abortions, activists come and shout the proceedings down. They won't let them be taken away. And at the same time, they're doing petitions and they're helping to elect candidates and they're going to the state capitol, right? All of it across the waterfront. That's what makes a difference.
I had Mark Joseph Stern, who wrote a fabulous piece at Slate about the Pennsylvania decision about abortion. And that decision rested on something I thought was absolutely powerful. And it rested on the ERA that was in their constitution. And they said that what this anti-abortion move is by definition, sex discrimination. And since the ERA does not allow discrimination by sex, then therefore these anti-abortion moves are in fact a violation of our constitution. Well, I decided, okay, how many states have ERAs? Okay, so I immediately went, I think there's like 22 of them, Felicia, okay? I mean, broad ERAs, and then there are some that are more conscripted, but 22 of them, and I'm like, oh my God, we need to start now making sure in all those states, including I believe Texas has an ERA, that they start taking these to court using the sort of the language and the understanding of the interpretation by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And of course, Mark Joseph Stern said, yeah, but they have conservative courts. I said, I don't care. I want the fight. That's what I get from you is we need the fight. We need the scream. We need the petition. And there are 22 states currently that have ERAs. So let's use 21. That's not Pennsylvania. We've already gotten that one in our pocket. Let's go after these. This is really important. And then the other thing that I thought about as I was reading your book and I was reading an article you wrote, we're talking about the popular referendum. So you mentioned, though, look what happened in Ohio. Look what happened in Kansas. We don't have referendum in New Hampshire. We can't do it. And it turns out that only 26 states allow popular referendum. So then what happens to the rest of us? And this is where I suddenly began to realize that there is an answer. It's an answer that people need to accept. And I wrote, only 26 states allow popular referendum. States with the most strict abortion laws have no referendum. That's Alabama and Louisiana and Texas. And I said, therefore, their only option is Biden in 2024. Because they don't have referendum, but they do have a chance to vote for a president. And the president who they will vote for is one who is committed to protecting a woman's rights. And therefore, if you don't have a referendum, your referendum is actually in the November election. And you may not like Joe. He may be old. He may shuffle. He may be 81. But if you care about this issue, he is your referendum. And I think in a lot of ways that that's how it needs to be packaged, given what we've seen happen in conservative states. But what happens if you're in a conservative state and you don't have a referendum? Then what do you do? Then you have to look at the November election.
Right. And I think the same is true for Congress. I mean, there's been this bill called the Women's Health Protection Act kicking around in both houses of Congress for about a decade. You know, if there was a pro-abortion rights Congress that was committed to this issue, they could pass it. You know, and if we had a Democratic president, he would sign it. They would sign it. Right? So I think constitutional protection is also appropriate. Like, I think Roe v. Wade was a good decision. And, you know, maybe someday we'll have something like that again, but probably not for a little while, given the Supreme Court. But we can do that, right? We can elect a Congress and we can elect a president with all of our reservations.
And we can go back to trying to pass the ERA nationally.
That's right.
I mean, again, after reading Pennsylvania, I'm like, oh my God, now I understand why I need to be committed to an ERA at a national level. And again, by connecting those dots, because I don't want to go body part by body part, operation by operation. I want to look at the whole gestalt of women's health, and I want to protect women's health. And therefore, an equal rights amendment basically says you cannot discriminate on the basis of sex. And that is a bigger protection than basically looking at, you know, one opportunity. What about IVF? What about this? I mean, I don't want all those things. I want something broader that recognizes and respects women. The title of her book, A Woman's Life is a Human Life, My Mother, Our Neighbor, and the Journey from Reproductive Rights to Reproductive Justice. Felicia Kornblau is a professor of history at the University of Vermont with a secondary appointment in gender, sexuality, and women's studies, as well as an affiliated faculty member in Jewish studies. Thank you for writing this book, and how lucky you were to have such an incredible mom.
Thank you. I'm so glad you care about this issue.
Oh, God, yes. This, everyone, is a Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be back tomorrow. Ciao. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back, let's go way on, way back when. I didn't even know you couldn't have been too much more than 10.